Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you. Dividends come in the end. For more information, you can go to www.mecu.com or click on their banner at steinershow.org, mecu.com for the Baltimore Credit Union. We've been covering the issues that are facing the state in the state legislature this session when we conducted the Annapolis Summit with the governor and the president of the Senate and the speaker of the House. The issue of wind power came up in both hours. This has become a linchpin of Governor Martin O'Malley's legislative issues that he's bringing before the state. He wants to erect wind turbines off the Maryland coast, maybe generating, he hopes, a third of the state's electricity carbon-free. There's a debate about the efficacy of that. Some people want it, some people don't. There are issues in Washington, D.C., where energy tax breaks are waning in the United States Congress. How would we pay for it? Other people are saying if we don't do this, that we'll be relying on fossil fuels. You also see stories in today's paper about the people want to see gas drilling in western Maryland and a poll. The polls can say anything they want, but that was one thing that came out today. Coal subsidies are being debated for Maryland coal as well. How do we define a renewable energy? What does renewable mean? Does it mean gas? Does it mean nuclear? Does it mean gas and solar? Well, we're going to tackle that starting with wind because that is what's on the table. We are joined here in studio by Dr. Kenneth Lewis, who is a volunteer board member with the Maryland Conservation Council. Welcome, Kenneth. Good to have you in the studio.
Thank you.
Joining us once again is Mike Tidwell, founder and director of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network. And good to have you with us again, Mike. We got Mike there? All right, Mike?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, good.
Thanks for having me back.
And always great to have you. And Malcolm Wolf, director of the Maryland Energy Commission. Welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
So, and folks, join us here at 410-319-8888. This is one of the major pieces of legislation to be debated now in the coming weeks in the late state legislature. And let's start with Malcolm Wolf. I mean, I'd like you to begin, if you would. I mean, if I'm incorrect, or if I'm correct, I should say, that last year the Maryland Energy Commission administration had more of a jaundiced view about wind power than they do this year. So tell me what's going on this year that's changed things, and what is this legislation telling us?
Well, several years ago, when Governor O'Malley came into office, we looked at our energy future and saw a world where we were importing 30-40% of our electricity from out of state. Our fleet of power plants was over 40-50 years old, and our prices were too high. So we knew we needed to take control of our energy future, and we wanted to do it in a way that was clean for public health as well as clean for the environment, and we enacted a 20% renewable portfolio standard. So by 2022, in 11 years, the goal is to get 20% of our power from clean renewable sources, which still means that 80% of our power is going to come from something else. We're currently 90% coal and nuclear. So the challenge is, how do we get from where we are today to be 20% renewable? We're going to do as much as we can on solar, as much as we can with land-based wind. There's some interesting things going on with poultry litter, trying to convert that to energy. But Maryland's most abundant resource is offshore wind. And that's something that Governor O'Malley has made over the last couple of years a real priority. How do we harness the wind that's blowing, you know, about 10 miles off the shore of Maryland?
So let me turn to Kenneth Lewis, then we'll go to Mike Tidwell. So, Kenneth, just very quickly before we get into some deeper issues here, I mean, you obviously are, from your lapel and from your definition here, are a man who sees himself as an environmentalist. Somebody cares about the environment and our future. So why are you opposed to wind power?
Well, there are a number of reasons, and we are the only environmental group, that is the Maryland Conservation Council, that is opposing this in the legislature.
Who is the Maryland Conservation Council?
Who are you? It's a 40-year-old umbrella conservation group that's been around a long time, was very much involved in the wildlands issues in the past. So they've been down at the legislature for a long time, even before I joined them.
That's good. I'm sorry. So why are you opposed to wind
power?
Well,
we first became involved in this because of our concerns for the environment. Renewable energy techniques all have a very large footprint. They take up a lot of land, whether it's on terrestrial land or whether it's in the ocean. And we're concerned about that, and we're concerned about the impact on bird life and on this offshore energy issue on the marine environment itself. But after that, and as we studied this through a lot of state and federal databases, we became quite concerned about the cost of doing this is going to be passed on to ratepayers, both individual ratepayers and businesses in the state. And that's a second issue we're concerned about. Thirdly, the issue of even the feasibility of this is in question. A Georgia Tech study states that there are no wind turbines that are developed that will withstand a Class 3 hurricane. And we wonder how you can even plan for a program and consider its costs if you don't have the materials and equipment to even set it up. So those are a number of the issues that we're quite concerned about, and we've not really received very good answers from the wind proponents.
Mike Tidwell.
Yeah. You talk to any of the developers that are planning to keep wind farm in Massachusetts, and all the wind developers who have shown interest off the coast of Maryland. And they will all tell you that they're planning to build wind farms that can survive a Category 3 hurricane, which, by the way, is extremely rare in the mid-Atlantic. The good news environmentally, I mean, I'm an environmentalist. My group, Chesapeake Climate Action Network, is dedicated to preserving the environment. We certainly wouldn't endorse any kind of energy solution that we thought was had a net negative. I think it's important to remember that Kenneth said his was the only environmental group that I know of that is strongly opposed to this, and the vast majority of environmental organizations in the state support it. And the Department of the Interior, just a couple of weeks ago in downtown Baltimore, announced that they had done a multi-year environmental study of the potential environmental impacts of offshore wind power from the coast of New Jersey to the coast of Virginia, and concluded that there would be no significant environmental impacts to marine or avian species from proposed offshore wind power. So I think there is lots of data that answers Kenneth's questions, and it's all encouraging and positive.
So I want to come back to some of the issues we'll raise here. Let me just start with the question of one of the questions of cost. Washington Post just reported a little bit ago that maybe last month, that Congress retreating from funding kind of clean energy projects, they maintain raises doubts about whether developers could secure the financing for offshore wind farms, even with the enhancements that Governor Martin O'Malley has offered. And I wonder, how is that being heard in Annapolis, and how are people responding to that? I guess we can, Malcolm or Mike can take that one on. Malcolm?
Sure. Certainly the expiration of the current federal tax credits that are really doing a great job in keeping renewable energy projects and other projects going in this country, if those are in fact allowed to lapse, it will have a big impact on projects across the country. With respect to offshore wind, the cost of offshore wind would go down if you have a federal tax credit. If you don't have a federal tax credit, however, we think these projects are still going to be able to go forward. They'll probably be smaller, because the bill has a really tight, as Governor O'Malley called it, a tight strike zone. We put in a bunch of protections in order to make sure that the impact to consumers is as minimal as possible. First and foremost, there's a threshold test before a project can be approved to make sure that the projected cost is under $2 to the average Maryland household. So there's the $2 threshold test. The second is a 2.5% potential impact for businesses. The overall cost, this is the third test, has to be less than $200 a megawatt hour. So without the federal tax credit, it may be more difficult for them to get under all three of those tests. But if they don't do it, then they won't get built, and they won't be able to take advantage of the program. So we're very confident developers will find a way to reduce costs and get in there. The fourth and final part of that strike zone that I want to mention is the net benefits test to Maryland. There's a provision in the bill that says that this has to be a benefit to Maryland. Otherwise, the Public Service Commission is not allowed to approve it, which means the developer has to be hiring Marylanders and supplying this with Maryland products and making sure that minority businesses are fully engaged and participating. If they are outsourcing this beyond Maryland, then they're probably not going to pass the net benefits test. So we've done everything we can to make sure that this is a net win for Maryland in terms of putting electricity on the ground and jobs for our citizens.
Now, I mean, one of the things, Kenneth Lewis, legislators I've talked to, this is one of the big sticking points for them, whether or not the cost of this is real. I think Tom Middleton, who chairs the Finance Committee, was just saying that this is this the ratepayer cost is something that will kill it. From his perspective, what's your perspective?
Who are you asking?
Well, you can go, Malcolm, then I'll go over to Kenneth. Go ahead.
The cost that we're estimating is about $2 on a monthly bill at most. And as over the course of 20 years, we expect the cost of traditional electricity to keep going up, since the price of wind is free, that cost really is a worst-case scenario. We think it's going to be less over time. You can save that money by switching a light bulb in your home. And that's why I wasn't surprised when a number of polls, I think there's now three polls, that are showing that the vast majority of Marylanders support paying a little bit extra, up to $2, for really advancing a future. The power plants that are keeping Maryland, the lights on in Maryland today, are 70% of them are over 40 years old. So the investments we make today are going to be around for a long time. If we want a cleaner future, sometimes it takes a light bulb worth of energy to make those startup investments.
Let me comment on the costs. Last year, the governor's proposal was scheduled to support this with power purchase agreements, and that did not fly in the legislature. And so they've changed the financing to an offshore renewable energy credit system like that's been developed in New Jersey. However, two independent economic reports have said that if New Jersey goes forward with that OREC plan, it will negatively impact the economics of the state and the future.
Now, Mike Tidwell, people's ears can glaze over when they hear certain stuff around the money issues, or people are worried about their bills and money going up and how we're going to pay for this. One of the issues that people don't talk about, though, it seems to me, is that, and someone said to me the other day, and you can debunk this if you like, but I'd like to talk about it for a minute, which is that, let's say, for argument's sake, we built this wind energy across up and down the Maryland seacoast, that there's no way for that energy to get from the shore to the rest of the state. And that one person argued with me that what we should have done is pass MAP, which was clearly bringing energy from Western Maryland here, and clearly it was done with coal and with mountaintop removal and all the issues inherent in that. But that the MAP system would be a system that could take the electricity done by wind power to the rest of the state, but we don't want to build it. And transmission is the big issue here. So would you comment on that?
Yeah, I mean, just generally on the issue of cost first, the wind power is expensive compared to what? Compared to coal? I mean, we know the external costs of coal are just staggering. In fact, University of Boston School of Public Health, Jonathan Levy, submitted testimony to the Senate Finance Committee last week saying that this one wind farm that the governor's proposing, 310 megawatts, would save the region, the Mid-Atlantic region, about $2 billion in health costs over the next 20 years just from backing coal out of the system. Coal is so bad for us. There's so much particulate matter. There's so much asthma caused by it. It generates so much of our electricity in the region that one moderate-sized wind farm off the coast of Maryland would save $2 billion and avoid 300 premature deaths in the region. And the state of Maryland alone would save about half a billion of that $2 billion. So, you know, expensive compared to what? And in terms of and that's why also a lot of doctors and nurses increasingly across the state are supporting the governor's bill, and they rallied in Annapolis last week in lab coats and scrubs.
Before you go on to the question I asked, let me stop for a second and come back to what I asked in a minute, because what you raise is important. And I think that one of the issues here is when we're talking about energy costs, the legislature, most legislatures, whether it's a national legislature or the state legislatures, don't take into account Kenneth Lewis, what Mike Tidwell is talking about, which are the costs of dirty energy, dirty of coal and oil and what they do to us. That's never taken into account. We talk about the 2.5% increase on businesses, $2 per month for consumers. But that's just a teeny part of what the real meaning of cost is when we talk about the cost of how we get our energy.
Yes, I don't disagree with that at all, but I think it's important to remember that since wind is inconstant, you have to back it up with fossil fuel plants. You do not shut down coal or oil or gas-fired plants, because when the wind's not blowing, you have to have that backup generation. And it's happened in Europe that they've not closed down coal plants to back up all the wind they have over there. As a matter of fact, the more wind energy, electrical energy you have, the more backup you have to have to support the grid when the wind's not blowing.
So, Mike Tidwell, how do you respond to that?
Well, Malcolm would be a good person to respond to that. But the bottom line is, I mean, that's just backup generation. That's not constant baseload production that we now get from coal. The health benefits still come from bringing wind power into the system. I know, Malcolm, you probably have a better answer.
Let me jump in on both of those points. One of the advantages that Maryland has is that we are part of what's known as the PJM transmission grid. It's the largest transmission grid in the country. It's 14 states, 50 million people. So we've got a lot of generation among ranges all the way from Illinois and New Jersey down to Virginia. So we've got a lot of generation in those 14 states. We're not going to be there's no question that we're going to have lots of plants that are on and off, and they're constantly turning on and off. Every time you flip on and off the switch, they adjust the output of the power plants. So the fact that the wind doesn't always blow is, of course, true. But we know that particularly on offshore, it blows about that those plants will have about a 40% capacity. So you plan for that, particularly at the level of scale that we're talking about, the transmission grid operators have no problem integrating that wind into the system. But the other point that Mr. Tidwell pointed out I thought was really important, there was an interesting study going on by some doctors in New York City hospitals when they happened to have that blackout back in, I think it was 2003, when kind of the East Coast, New York City, went dark, and they found that heart attacks and asthma cases plummeted in the next 2 or 3 days because the power plants in Ohio were shut down during that blackout. So a lot of people don't think about the connection between kind of dirty air and what it really means to your health. But there's a huge database of empirical data showing the correlation. And as we're talking about the cost and we're talking about the jobs, it's important not to forget about the public health dimension of a cleaner future.
I mean, when you think, though, I mean, you know, I've read the reports from Germany and other places that talk about the role wind plays is an important role, but they also talk about its limitations on the grid and having to be backed up, I think, as Kenneth was saying, by coal, which they still pump a lot of in Germany. But the issue to me seems that it's much larger than that. In that, you know, when we think about building these wind turbines off the shore, it seems in some ways politically very important for Governor Martin O'Malley to want to do this. On the other hand, many of us want to see renewable energy be at the front of the train instead of the caboose of the train when it comes to our future. But it seems the way we're doing it doesn't fit into a long-range model or plan about how to replace fossil fuels. You know, we'll have a little wind energy here. Let's have a little bit of solar here. Let's do this, and we can put the pegs in. But Mike Tidwell, how does that face what we really – how does that answer what we really face?
Well, I think that Maryland back in the early 2000s had no meaningful legislation to incentivize clean renewable energy, none. I've been a clean energy activist in this state for 10 years.
Yes, you have.
And 10 years ago, there was no clean car standards for Maryland cars. There was no Greenhouse Gas Reduction Act. There was no Healthy Air Act, cleaning up coal plants. There was no clean electricity standard. Now we have all of those. The first law that Maryland passed, that the General Assembly passed on this issue, was in 2004, the Renewable Portfolio Standard, basically a fancy phrase for a clean electricity standard. It said at the time that 7.5% of our electricity had to come from clean sources by the year 2022. Now that standard has already been bumped up to 20%. Clean renewable energy by 2022. In other words, you tend, in all of these cases, whether it's any kind of social economic change, civil rights, et cetera, you start out with a few weak bills that advocates know are not enough, but then you improve on them over time. You change the psychology of consumers and political leaders, and then it builds on itself. And I think that that's what we're seeing in Maryland. The latest installment of that plan is to develop this offshore wind industry. However, what I think makes offshore wind different than all the legislation that has come before in the last 8 years, going back to 2004, is that offshore wind is finally a solution that is equal to the scale of the problem. We have enormous wind potential, just enormous. It's our version of sunshine that they have in Arizona or geothermal energy that they have in Iceland. It's just a lot of wind potential, and we can get 20-25% of our electricity load in coming years from wind, and I think that that's why this is so pivotal. I think it does get to what you're talking about, Mark. It finally is sort of the big visionary legislation that's a paradigm shifter, a game changer, and I think that's why the governor's so drawn to it.
And so, Kenneth Lewis, I mean, in the face of what we face in this country, when it comes to fossil fuels and what they're doing to our health and our environment, to our economy, to our world politics and the rest, what do you suggest we do?
Well,
if it's not wind?
I think that nuclear already provides 30%, a third of our energy produced in this particular state. It's Calvert Cliffs 3 on 124 acres, small footprint, would, according to the long-term energy report that was just released in December, would provide 10% of Maryland's energy going forward on one spot with transmission lines already in place without all of these unknowns there.
Now, this is I'm glad you said that, because this seems to me to be the bogeyman in the room in many ways in this country and in this state, because defining what we mean by renewable and that kind of energy. I'd like Malcolm and Mike to respond to what you just heard. Malcolm?
Sure. I'd actually agree with Dr. Lewis. Nuclear has a huge role for a diverse energy future. Maryland is 30% nuclear. Governor O'Malley and I do support a new power plant at Calvert 3, but we've adopted all-of-the-above strategy. We need traditional coal. We need natural gas. We need nuclear, but we also need clean renewable. The renewable portfolio standard is a 20% goal, which means 80% has to come from something else. The reality, however, is that Constellation has backed out of building a new Calvert 3 reactor. The new owner, Électricité de France, does not have a U.S. owner. The federal supports are going away. Doesn't seem like anyone's stepping up to finance that project. And in the wake of the reality that a $10 billion, every time I get a number, it's larger than the next, since that project doesn't seem to be going forward, we need to be doing everything we can to get new generation on our grid from all sorts of mechanisms.
Now, Mike Tidwell, what is your take? What is your take on nuclear energy?
Well, I am not anti-nuclear and never have been. I am pro-climate solution. You know, my mission in life is to help turn off the global carbon dioxide spigot and save our atmosphere and our civilization. And if I thought that nuclear power was the fastest way to do that and the best, most cost-effective way to do it, I'd say build the nuclear power plant right next to my house. You know, despite the weapons proliferation issue and the potential local radiation threat and all the rest, I'd say build the nuclear power plant right next to me, my wife, and my 14-year-old child, because my goal is to solve global warming. The reality is nuclear is essentially carbon-free, but it is so expensive. It's one of the rare examples of an energy system that has just gotten more and more expensive over time, whereas wind power, the price goes down. Solar, the price has gone down over time. And after the tsunami in Japan and other issues that we've had with nuclear power, the earthquake in Virginia that shut down a nuclear power plant for the first time in the history of America, a nuclear power plant shut down for more than a month because of an earthquake. I mean, when there's an earthquake and you have wind turbines, there's no pollution released. You know, the tsunami in Japan actually passed right through a coastal wind farm and with no harm to that wind farm. So I just think that the spectacular cost of nuclear, the associated dangers, it's not the most sensible solution to climate change. And I think wind power just makes a lot more sense.
We're going to take a brief break here in a second and come back. I'm going to get our listeners in here at 410-319-8888. What do you think of Governor Martin O'Malley's proposal about wind power? And what do you think about the future of our energy? How do you think it affects our jobs? Think of all the joblessness in the city and around certain parts of our state that could be cured by developing new kinds of energy industries. Should nuclear be part of that? What will wind do? Do you think it's going to be too expensive for us? Even if it raised your bill a little, would you want it? What are your alternative thoughts? 410-319-8888 is the number here. We want to hear your thoughts on this debate. To me, which is, you know, even though it's not as sexy and sensual as some of the debates going on in Annapolis, it is one of the key debates for our future, of our children and our state and our country and our world. 410-319-8888. Bring your ideas to the airwaves. We'll be right back with our guests. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We're here with Dr. Kenneth Lewis, volunteer board member of the Maryland Conservation Council, Mike Tidwell, founder and director of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network, and Malcolm Wolf, who is director of the Maryland Energy Administration, talking about the wind power legislation in front of us now in the state legislature. And the question is, I want to hear from you all, 410-319-8888, what should be our energy future and how should we get there? Is it wind? Is it solar? Somebody argued in the show a little while back that we should be doing is not worrying about building big gigantic wind turbines or anything else, but we should be letting people put solar on the top of their house across the state and give people tax deductions to do it. Is that the way to go? Is nuclear power the future? We talked about that in the previous half hour with our guests, and I didn't get a chance to throw this out, but we will, and we can talk about it. All three of our guests seem to think it might be a good, solid thing to have nuclear power in the third in our state, a new plant built. But think about what happens when we mine uranium, the thousands of people who have died as a result of being uranium miners, what it does to the environment where those things are mined, and what do you do with the spent rods? Those are questions that you have to take into account as well. As Mike Tidwell earlier in the show talked about the larger cost of different energy. What's the cost of that? 410-319-8888 is the number here. And any of you gentlemen have a comment before we hit the phones?
Just one comment with regard to jobs. When the whole renewable energy issues began to come to the fore about a decade ago, the primary move was to reduce carbon dioxide emissions into the atmosphere because of global climate change. It seems that this has almost evolved into a jobs bill. There's very little talk about emission reduction by the offshore wind and focusing on jobs. And even there, I would raise serious question about particularly the idea of manufacturing jobs in Maryland. When major global manufacturers of turbines like Vestas are laying off people in Europe because they don't have the demand because of the sovereign debt problems there, where countries are no longer willing to subsidize this, the idea that we're going to have manufacturing of wind turbines in Maryland seems not very realistic.
Though I will say, and I'll hear what Malcolm or Mike has to say about this. I mean, you get the exact opposite when you hear Governor Culver from Iowa, who's been on this show before, talking about the amount of jobs that were created in the Midwest building turbines and what that's created for them.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. This is Malcolm.
Malcolm, go ahead.
The solar energy industry in Maryland a few years ago was non-existent. You had a couple small businesses that were installing it on their friends' homes. That was it. We've now got over 2,000 people employed directly in the Maryland solar industry because we've taken a leap ahead. We said we wanted 2% of our power from solar. That has created a market. It didn't take state subsidies or state tax dollars. By creating that market certainty, the market has responded. The industry is booming. I have seen the same thing with Governor Culver in Iowa, Governor Ritter in Colorado. These industries have developed. I think we're going to see the same thing with offshore wind. If Maryland has the foresight to be an early mover and to build a project off of its coast, when the rest of the East Coast wakes up to this and starts building their plants, Maryland businesses are going to have the experience. They're going to know the supply chain. There's a lot of attention, I think, misplaced on the turbines. But there's 8,000 components, I'm told, in an offshore wind farm. So whether or not the turbines are actually built here or not, we can do the steel in Maryland. We can do the shipbuilding in Maryland. We'll need divers. We'll need welders. There's a whole supply chain. And the estimates are that a project, even an initial project like this one, would generate over 1,300 jobs. And I think most of them are going to be in Maryland because you've got to have an awful lot of operation and maintenance as well. So I think this is one of the many reasons to do this is because of the job creation.
Very quickly, Kenneth, I want to get to the phones. Many people are calling in to join us.
I heard Governor Culver's discussion at the Finance Committee hearing, and he was also challenged about the numbers of businesses that had actually closed down as the demand for turbines has decreased. So there are pluses and minuses to this whole business.
410-319-8888. Kalik, you're on the air.
Yes, good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening, Kalik.
I don't hear anybody talking about tidal energy. The energy produced by the tidal stream of the ocean. And, you know, tidal power is the only technology that draws on energy that is inherent in the ocean. And so I think it's more efficient than the wind, developing the wind fields, but at the same time, I do like the governor's idea, which I don't agree with him on a lot of things, but I like his idea of mixing. So I think the proper mix of nuclear power, making use of tidal power or tidal energy and wind power, whatever we got, solar power for the homes, I think is great because we create a big grid that lessens the impact on a central source of power. So I think we and all of that together is job creation.
Important points, Kalik. And Mike, you want to pick up on that?
Yeah, I mean, Malcolm may know more about tidal energy than I do. I believe that there is a if not utility scale, at least a pretty large tidal project that's underway, I think, in Portugal. But I believe it's just a technology that isn't quite where wind power is. In Europe right now, there are 49 offshore wind farms, some going back as far as 20 years. Back in operation, but tidal energy I don't know as much about.
Yeah, actually, there is a Maryland-based company that's actively exploring tidal energy. We're partnering with them at the Maryland Energy Administration. It's called WaveBob, Wave B-O-B, and they're looking at building kind of really big buoys, essentially, that'll bob up and down with the tides and create energy. Very excited about that, but at this point, it is still in the research and development phase. It's not something that is commercially viable yet. I think Lockheed is partnering with them, and a number of other big companies are exploring it. It's part of an exciting future. But in contrast to offshore wind, we've had offshore wind turbines going for over 20 years in Europe. Thousands of megawatts are already installed. So as part of Governor O'Malley's all of the above, we're looking at tidal energy, but offshore wind has the potential to just really be online in just the next 5 or 10 years.
Okay, I think you probably have a different idea.
No, I don't have any comments about that one.
410-319-8888 is the number here. And Ajax, you're on the air.
Okay. Hi, Mark.
Hi.
And Kevin and the people there. Another point on the jobs thing is that in the New Jersey reports, the two of them claimed that because of the cost of offshore wind, that the cost would and hurt businesses and industries to the point where there would be a job loss over the job gain potential there. So, and again, the, Iowa had to say that they did lose jobs too. And I would say that the renewable portfolio standard is not obtainable. It should be a clean energy standard with clean nuclear energy included. You're never going to get there with wind and solar and the other types of things that are being considered as clean energy. And the as to the clean part of wind, I really doubt that very much. Is because coal is one of the greatest producers of energy here in Maryland, that it has to be ramped up and down to make up for the loss of when it isn't doing, it isn't going. And even if it is from other states, going to go into the PJM, the ramping up and down of coal is going to be more, use more energy than just having coal go as a, you know, steady sort of state. So I don't see how you can say that it, that asthma will be wiped out and all the rest of this stuff as far as taking coal off the market because of wind energy. It's just not going to happen.
All right, well, let me let our guest kind of...
Mark, I got to jump in.
Mike Tidwell, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, anybody who's listening, these are environmentalists. Ajax and Kenneth are presenting themselves as environmentalists who support nuclear power as a solution. And what I just heard Ajax do is, in a way, defend coal, or we can't get rid of coal. And the reality is every major environmental group in Maryland, from Sierra Club to the Chesapeake Climate Action Network to the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, Environment Maryland, National Wildlife Federation, go on and on. The really big environmental groups all support wind power and are working very hard to push coal out of our system, out of our grid. It is achievable. Iowa does. It is a fact that Iowa today gets 20% of its electricity from wind power. I as an environmentalist myself and a lifelong birder and hiker of the Appalachian Trail and et cetera, and the father of a 14-year-old, I just don't think that it is mainstream environmentalism to embrace nuclear power and defend coal. I think the mainstream environmentalism is to embrace wind power and solar, and that's the direction, thankfully, that the governor wants to go as well.
So before we turn to Malcolm, his thoughts, Kenneth, you want to jump in there? I mean, it seems to me that to respond to Mike Tidwell's argument?
Well, just because there's one that everybody else is going to jump off the ledge doesn't mean that's necessarily the right way to go. I think that bringing up these questions that have not been debated very clearly are appropriate in making a decision like this. There's a lot of emotionalism going on here with people walking around with blue T-shirts and carrying signs, but we need to look at the facts, and there are a lot of facts from both state and federal government agencies that are nonpartisan to look at.
But there are also a lot of facts about the dangers, even though most of my guests here seem to support it on some level, the dangers of nuclear power and what it leaves us with as well. But you and Ajax before, who's been on my show, seem to support that idea.
As he said before, it's all a trade-off, but you have to look at facts to make those trade-offs. The Sierra Club, for instance, is totally stated non-nuclear. So from an intellectual point of view, they don't even consider that a part of the mix.
Malcolm, you want to jump in before we go back to the phones?
I'm not going to engage in a debate over nuclear or offshore wind. I think we need all of the above. I will agree, though, that we need to be based on facts, and there are a number of the things that have been thrown out are simply not true. Just a couple examples. The New Jersey report that says there could be an economic impact, that is dealing with a pilot project in state waters. What we're talking about in Maryland is a commercial-scale project, so we get these economies of scale and we get the public health and the job benefits, and that's that significant. If we do this in a we're talking about commercial scale generation, not someone putting a windmill in their backyard, and that's how you get the economies of scale and minimize the price impacts.
And Mark, I'll
go ahead, Mike.
The job statistics that Ajax and Kenneth cited from New Jersey, those studies were funded by the Koch brothers. They were funded by the fossil fuel industry. I mean, these are numbers from people who want to burn coal in New Jersey. So if we want to talk facts, that's fine, but let's not throw out job numbers that are created by the Koch brothers who committed themselves to making sure that this country doesn't do anything about global warming and continues to burn coal. I don't think those are the kind of quote-unquote facts that we really want to be, you know, having a debate about.
Let me jump back to the phones, if I might. We'll come right back to our guests here. 410-319-8888. Next two callers up are Andrea and Stephen, or Stefan. So you're both going to get on the air here. And 410-319-8888 to join our conversation. Andrea, you're on the air.
Yes, I was just saying not so much even just Iowa, but even just like you mentioned, Colorado, Idaho, Utah, and where I transplanted from, even though I'm from Oklahoma, Washington State. I lived in the area with wind power, and I was, that's lead to a question too that I was going to ask, like who is going to own that power? Because where I lived, the county owned that, and it made such a difference in the utility cost. My electric was only about $40 a month year round. So, but I think it's awesome to do it. And then on the job issue, so many people when I was in Washington came over from this area to work, and so just think, people can stay home. From your welders, your pipe fitters, not to mention your inside wiremen, your outside wiremen. So your union brothers can go back to work. And, you know, most of your union headquarters are in this area. And, you know, with the change in the economy, you know, your IBEW is really suffering. So instead of them having to travel, they can be right here at home. Like the art, and in addition to the wind power, there's a silicone plant for the solar panels in Washington. It put about 2,000 people to work, and just your entry-level employees started out at $20 an hour. So I think it would be a great economic boost for the area if it's put in place properly. So I hope everyone kind of does the research, you know, before they jump in feet first and kind of look at all parts of the country that it's successful and maybe, you know, take a piece or model, you know, a certain state. So then that way they can do it here, because like I said, feasibly, it can really work and it can really put, you know, people back to work in this area.
Let's talk about jobs for a minute. And if you'd like to start off, I think Malcolm and Kenneth, this is where a real divide comes around both of you on this issue. And Kenneth Lewis begin, and then we go to Malcolm Wolf, and then we'll go to our next caller, Stefan.
Well, I think the job promises are just that. They've been highly exaggerated. And I would like to see some facts as to what these are based on, but I've not seen any of this actually presented at any of the hearings before the state legislature. It did come out this past summer at one of the hearings because it was specifically asked how many maintenance jobs were related to the two land-based wind farms that we have in Western Maryland, and the answer was 7 each.
Now, Malcolm Wolf?
Sure. The land-based facilities generated about $250 million of investment in the state and lots of construction jobs. But you're right, land-based wind doesn't take nearly the kind of maintenance that an offshore wind facility in a marine environment would take. Almost 50% of the jobs would be operation and maintenance jobs for an offshore wind farm. I think the caller had a great point. Lots of other regions in this country and around the world have embraced a cleaner, renewable future, and they're getting the job creation and they're benefiting from lower bills at the same time and a healthier environment. Maryland has a choice. Our best renewable resource lies off our shore. A recent University of Delaware study found that offshore wind could power 70% of Maryland's electricity needs, and even more if you go to deeper waters. So the choice is, do we want to have a cleaner future where we embrace the resource that we have, or do we want to invest in traditional technologies? Because as our fleet is old, we need to be investing in something. We're either going to be paying money for coal and natural gas, or we're going to be paying money for a cleaner offshore wind future.
Let's go back to the phones of 410-319-8888. As we know, we're debating the issue of wind power and renewable energies. It's before the state legislature. It's the one of the next big issues to come up for votes in our House and Senate. And Stefan, you're on the air.
Yeah, how y'all doing?
Very well. Welcome.
All right. I had I remember a long time ago on Biddle and Chester Street, that was a house on the corner. Y'all remember this, when Jimmy Carter came in town, and that house was all on the news and everything. And I also noticed that in East Baltimore, I think that's on Pulaski Street, they already got some solar homes up in, on past somewhere on Pulaski Highway up, and they got with solar energy and solar panels, you know. And I always start seeing windmills going up already. So I guess if it can save some money and save the environment, I guess it's okay with me. You know what I'm saying?
Gotcha, Stefan. Thank you so much.
All right, bye-bye.
Appreciate it. And I do remember that, those houses. I also remember the battle we just had in South Baltimore where a woman was not allowed to put up a wind turbine in her house, which I thought was a huge mistake, but was not allowed to.
There were 5,000 Marylanders that have put up some kind of renewable system on their home, whether it's wind or solar or geothermal system. In fact, the Maryland Energy Administration has a neat interactive map, if I could put in a quick plug. If you go to energy.maryland.gov/map, you could actually look up and see where are clean energy projects in your neighborhood and in your community.
I will check that out. Go ahead, Kenneth.
Yeah, I'd just like to say that Maryland Conservation Council also strongly supports solar on buildings. You already have the impervious surfaces all around. You might as well put solar panels on them and get what energy we can out of them.
So let me talk to you about the politics where we are for the moment. And Malcolm, I'll start with you, and Ken, you can jump in here too. You two probably could answer this best, maybe Mike as well. But where are we now with this? I mean, it seems like this is a very tentative battle. That a lot of forces are arrayed against wind power. People are worried about the cost to the taxpayer, worried about whether we can afford to build these things, the cost to the ratepayers. And that seems to be the push at the moment, at least from the press that you read in the Post and the Sun. So tell me where you think you are, if you can, just honestly where we are politically with all this.
Sure. The bill has been obviously introduced, and it's being debated in both the House and the Senate. The Senate had a hearing last week. The House is having one on Thursday. And this is a similar issue to what was debated last year, but in light of the concerns raised, we've taken a different approach. So we've got an approach that doesn't require a mandatory contract. Instead, it's a portion of the renewable portfolio standard. It seems like the utilities are finding this approach much more acceptable, and the public health community and the unions and other constituents are really finding that this is something that that is going to help them. So I think the legislature is grappling with this. They want to. I think everyone likes the concept of clean, renewable energy, and we're all concerned about the potential cost. And that's why Governor O'Malley structured this bill so tightly to minimize the cost and maximize the clean energy and job benefits.
Good, Ken.
Well, certainly the business interests that testified are very concerned about the costs in terms of both the large businesses and the small businesses. And we've not really addressed the social justice issue.
Social justice issue of
increasing electricity costs for low-income citizens. Last year, 160,000 Marylanders applied for assistance with their electricity bills through the state's support system. Even minor increases in electricity costs weigh heavily on this particular group of citizens as opposed to others who can afford additional costs.
Mike?
Yeah. The environmental justice issue goes to the heart of wind power, and I think that it is one of the strongest arguments in favor of offshore wind. If you are African-American in this country, you are 40% more likely to have a coal plant that emits particulate matter that leads to the heart attacks and the asthma events that Malcolm was talking about earlier. If you're African-American, you're 40% more likely to have one of those located near your house. The reality is the NAACP in Maryland supports this. We've got lots of ministers, African-American ministers from Baltimore City and Prince George's County who sent a letter to the Senate last week, precisely on the issue of social justice and environmental justice. The reality is fossil fuels don't work for people of low income. again, we said earlier that Boston University School of Public Health said that this one wind farm that the governor wants to build would save our region $2 billion in health costs and save 300 lives. That's one of the main reasons that this debate is going on and why I think the politics are really lining up for this issue. We did a poll back in January from a firm called Opinion Works. It does lots of polling for lots of mainstream groups in Maryland. And they found that when you ask Marylanders, what is the a whole list of give them a whole list of reasons why their support for offshore wind, or to ask them what are the main reasons you would support offshore wind and why you would be willing to pay a little bit more on your utility bill. The number one reason people in Maryland gave in this poll in January was jobs, that they see this as an economic stimulus. And the second most popular answer was health, that people see this as something that's good for their children's health, good for the health of their communities. And I think that that's very interesting. So when anyone starts talking about how wind power is bad for the poor, or the economically disadvantaged, or the frail, it's the opposite. And I think average Marylanders know that, and that's why the politics are lining up so well.
We are just about out of time here. This has been really interesting. I hope that we've clarified some issues, and we'll see how this grows in the next month in the state legislature before the vote takes place. We encourage you to read about this. Go to our website, steinershow.org, to pick up the articles we've been talking about, and educate yourselves on this and make your voices heard to the state legislature. I want to thank Mike Tidwell, who you just heard, founder and director of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network. In our studios, Dr. Kenneth Lewis, volunteer board member of the Maryland Conservation Council, for being with us, and Malcolm Wolf, who is director of the Maryland Energy Administration. Thank all three of you for taking your time with our listeners today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure. And on the way out of here, I want to remind you that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines. It's a simple way to stay connected to the topics and events you care about most. Daily content on arts, culture, food design, style, green living, and much more can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at UrbaniteBaltimore.com. Following the Mark Steiner Show tonight, it's Wealthy Lifestyle with Deborah Owens. And tonight she's joined, it's the glamorous side of entrepreneurship with author Cheryl Wood. Later it's Money Power Day and the annual financial literacy event that we all encourage you to take part in as well. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Cricket Aronson. Our assistant producer is Cassandra Monsanto. Intern tonight are Alex Pearson and Elizabeth Walker. We're engineered by Regis Tucker. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, find out information about the issues and the guests we've had on our program, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for public radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.